The Tom Woods Show, episode 1693.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, by now you've probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Adam Curry is our guest today, and I couldn't be happier. Those of you who are in, let's say, my age cohort will certainly remember him as an MTV VJ beginning in the late 1980s. But since then, he's done quite a few interesting things, and in particular has been an absolute pioneer in podcasting, which may in fact be an understatement. We'll get into that a little bit later. And of course, he co-hosts No Agenda, which is a fantastic podcast that I know you'll want to check out. So I'm delighted to talk to him today. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be here. Finally, I guess. I've heard so many people say I should be on your show.
Wow. Well, I'm glad we made this work. Years ago, I was getting started with podcasting, and you and I on Twitter, you won't remember this, but we had a friendly interaction, like you were offering to help, and I thought, well, I'm not going to bother the godfather of podcasting, but I appreciated your, you know, the encouragement. So I want to talk about...
I do remember that, actually.
Oh, good.
I do remember that, absolutely.
Well, I want to talk about both you and your podcast and then some related issues. So I do want to talk about your... I mean, you've had really quite an eventful life. I mean, ups and downs like anybody, but my gosh, have you done, if not everything, then a lot of things. So you got started at MTV in 1987, and yet you'd been living in the Netherlands at that time. So how'd that come about?
Yeah, my parents moved to the Netherlands when I was 7 years old, which was quite a shock at the time. And certainly in the, so this was 72, I think, Americans were not even really liked. You know, there was a lot of businesses being set up in the Netherlands, Texas Instruments and other, I guess, technology companies. And the kids would walk around and go, "Hey, crazy American." So I really had an interesting time, you know, 3 years at international school. And then from one day to the next, my parents, you know, we had vacation, a week's off, I think, from school. My parents sat us down and said, "Guess what you guys are doing tomorrow?" I'm like, "Oh, what are we doing?" "You're going to Dutch school." And so I entered Dutch school at fifth grade, speaking very little Dutch.
Oh.
And yeah, and kind of went through this odd, I mean, it's a longer story, you know, odd process of kind of falling into pirate radio, which was really an important outlet at the time in the Netherlands, where they had only government-run radio and television stations. And their idea of top 40 or popular music was still kind of polka music. And then on these pirate FM radio stations, we'd be playing import records from, you know, Chicago Warehouse. I mean, Madonna even at a certain point, way before Madonna was Madonna. And from that, I actually rolled into a national radio show and television show in the Netherlands. At the time, it was kind of the gateway to Europe for entertainment, certainly. So everybody came through and was on our show. I mean, at the time, it was Madonna, Mick Jagger, Tina Turner, Bryan Adams, Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, you name it. And I met them all and interviewed them all. And it was an incredible time. And then in 87, I got a call from MTV. And it was Steve Leeds at MTV. And he said, "Hey, do you want to come and work for us at MTV?" And they had just started, I think, MTV Europe. They were thinking about it. And I said, "You mean in New York?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Sure. When should I be there?" And 2 months later, I was in Manhattan.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. And so you've met and interviewed all kinds of interesting people. You have any weird stories, like people who turned, I don't know, just bizarre interviews or strange things that happened or surprises? I mean, you must have some.
Well, Tom, I've been trying to write my book for several years. I actually got pretty far. Talked to a publisher, saw the contract, saw the non-disparaging clause and the morality clause. I'm like, now I remember why I'm in podcasting. No, I'm not interested. So I do relate to a lot of these stories on No Agenda, on the podcast. I think one of the coolest things I ever went through, which is actually now kind of bubbled up a little bit in regards to the Scorpions, Winds of Change, as a podcast that was kind of looking into, was this song perhaps written by the CIA to help stimulate the fall of the Berlin Wall? In 1989, just before the wall, I'm sorry, before David Hasselhoff brought down the Berlin Wall, there was something called the Moscow Music Peace Festival, which was Doc McGee was a guy. He was a manager of Bon Jovi and Motley Crue, and his Learjet had been caught smuggling, I think, marijuana into Miami or something. And instead of going to jail, they turned it around and said, well, you should do a drug and alcohol free concert in Moscow. And, you know, the state will sponsor it. Obviously, this was a CIA operation, but I went along for the trip. So it was, you know, one plane. It was, well, me, of course, and I had a small MTV crew. It was Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, Skid Row, Ozzy Osbourne, which was fantastic. Here's my story. So Ozzy was really out of it. And Sharon was really kind of a rotund, very homely looking British housefrau at the time. She's changed. It's like she's half the woman she was at the time. And Ozzy is standing in the middle of the aisle near the lavatory. And he said, Sharon, Sharon, I got to the bathroom. And someone was in there. And Sharon's like, oh, Ozzy. And he just pisses his pants right there. It was the oddest thing. And that was just, we hadn't even gotten to Moscow by then. So it's stories like that that are fun to tell to the grandchildren when I get them.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. All right, look, that'll last me. That's all I needed was the Ozzy Osbourne urination story. Now,
it's one of my faves.
I have no doubt. Now, you actually, if I'm reading this right, you registered the domain name MTV.com?
Yeah. So when I got to New York, I immediately got a Mac Plus and a 1200 baud modem. I'd already built a modem back in, you know, a couple of years back when I was 15, a 300 baud. No, actually, it was like a 75 baud modem. And I'd messed around with computers very early on. So the internet wasn't the web at the time. We had, you know, it was really hard to get on. It had a command line, a slip, a PPP connection, all this stuff. And then you had email, you had news groups, and you had something called Gopher, which was a text. It still exists today, a text-based kind of hyperlinking system, the precursor to the World Wide Web. And what I discovered is, even though it was hard to get on, once you were there, that's where the audience was. Because who had access to the internet at the time in 87, 88? Was college kids who were on college terminals. So I saw this whole world open up, and I was getting feedback from them about what I was saying, or, you know, so really I was figuring out how communities online could work. And I set up my own Gopher server so I could publish something I called Cyber Sleaze, which was just a text page of here's the latest gossip or whatever. And then I had it hosted at some wanky place in Reston, Virginia, I think, you know, like a small server I rented. And the guy said, hey, man, why don't you register a domain name for that? I said, okay. And I said, well, why don't you get me curry.com and I'll take mtv.com. And, well, what does that cost? Nothing. You just send the guy an email. Oh, okay. Well, give me elvis.com. And I got a whole bunch of really cool domain names. And then, but here's the kicker. So I was doing this and I was talking about it on the air at MTV. And the suits said, what is this thing you're doing? And I explained, I said, hey, I registered MTV.com. Is that okay? I mean, I'm just messing around and I'm providing some extra, you know, kind of feedback to my audience. And they said, yeah, you can have this, find the domain name. We have the AOL keyword. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine with that. And so after that, I just kind of started to build it up. And at a certain point around 93, I was, you know, I realized I was doing the same thing over and over again. You know, I lived in Jersey at the time, would drive into Manhattan, do my shows, and then go home. And I'd be on the internet until 3 a.m. trying to figure out what this was. And at this time, I'd gotten an email from a guy in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. He said, Adam, I love this Gopher stuff you're doing, but you should check out this this thing I've created. It's called a browser. And that was Mark Andreessen, who created the first browser, the Mosaic browser, and then went on to create Netscape. So I decided I had to do something with this. And I could live for a year with you know, without having any steady income. And I quit on air. I said, that's it. I'm going to go on the internet. That's where I think everything's going to be. And I left. And literally the Saturday after that, I was served papers by Viacom suing me for the domain name.
Now, obviously, they got it from you.
Yes, the lawsuit between Mr. Curry and Viacom Networks has been settled out of court, and neither party has any further comment.
Okay, I'm sure that's how it turned out.
And I started my first company soon after that. Isn't it crazy? It was so good.
How about that? Well, we'll just leave it there. But it goes to show that you were out in front when it came to the internet, and you've been out in front when it came to podcasting. I mean, so let's talk about that. I've heard people say that you invented the podcast. Do you think that's too much, or how would you describe your role in all this?
Well, the term, and I love saying I invented podcasting because it makes it so simple. You don't have to go into the whole story. I don't think inventions ever really come from one person in general. And I certainly did not invent RSS. But what I saw was, at the time, around 2000. And I was by that time, I moved back to Europe. We didn't have really broadband, but we had something new. It was called Always On Internet. So you didn't have to dial up. This was a revolution. Your computer could stay on and you didn't have to kick your kids off the phone line or switch it to the fax line. Many people won't remember this, but it was a crazy time. But there was no experience. So if you wanted to play a video or a song, you know, you would click and then it would wait and it would maybe 10 minutes or 20 minutes. And then we had experiences like real audio and real video, which were really in postage size, just crap. However, I figured if you could delay the notification and, you know, so I want to watch a video and my computer somehow knows I want to watch a video or listen to a song, it would download that for me before I wanted it. And then it would say, oh, I've got something new for you. Click on it. You could have a full screen great experience. So it was kind of like a time shift that I had come up with. And I went to Dave Weiner in New York at the time, who had done RSS for blogs. And I said, why, you know, that, which is a publish subscribe mechanism. You publish a blog and you have a reader, which used to be the Google reader before they killed it. And you could subscribe and you could kind of read through it like an inbox, different ways to do it, but some as an inbox. I said, why don't we do that where if there's a big file attached to it, the receiving side downloads it and until it's downloaded doesn't tell you there's something new. And so it took me a while to convince him to do that, but he did. And for 2 years maybe, we were messing around with it because there was no application until I saw my first iPod. And I looked at this thing and I went, holy crap, that's not just a jukebox, that's a radio receiver. It even looks like an old AM transistor radio. And I came up with the concept of, why don't I make a show, a radio show, and I'll have a little app. I built it in Apple script, which is proprietary to the Mac system, where you subscribe to a feed, and if the feed updates with a new show, it downloads it. At the time, downloads it to iTunes, puts it on your computer, syncs your iPod. We still had to do that. And then you pick it up in the morning and your new radio shows are on there. That's all categorized, et cetera. So I set about doing this and I did what I would consider the first podcast. We didn't have the name yet, the Daily Source Code. And the entire idea was, I'm not a software developer. I needed people to get enthusiastic to build these pod, we call them pod catchers, these apps that would bring it in. And so this was this continuous loop where I was just telling the developers, and we learned so many things about, you know, just how it seems so simple, but you can make a lot of mistakes. And unbeknownst to me, because I was pushing tons of bandwidth that I didn't really have, I was just putting it on my Mac drive. The guys at Apple had seen what was happening and they were following it and they were just letting me have all their bandwidth and not even telling me about it, which made sense in, you know, later in 2004, when Steve Jobs called me and said, hey, can I meet with you? Which was probably the most cool meeting of all, outside of Quincy Jones, maybe. And he said, man, I'd really like to put podcasting into iTunes. Are you okay with that? And I went, yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
I said, here, I've built this directory. Let me give it to you so we can get things started. Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. So, you know, is it really an invention? I have to give as much credit to Dave Weiner as to the many developers of the Podcatcher apps. I certainly was the spokeshole for the movement because everyone came to interview me. I was perfect for it. I was the perfect guy for this to happen. Ex-MTV VJ, kind of rocker guy. He's got the long hair. What's this tech angle? And, you know, so that made a lot of sense. And I took that and, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I certainly have a place in history.
I would say also, you can speak better to the average person than engineers can. They're wonderful people and indispensable, but they're hopeless when it comes to explaining anything.
This is one of the things I'm good at, is being in between technology and non-technology people. Because I know enough about code and how it all works that I'm dangerous. In fact, I've been forbidden to use certain types of software by people because I'm so dangerous with it. But I can translate kind of back and forth and say, oh, here's the benefit. Here's how it works.
Well, let me say thank you for what you did, because you have made my life so much better through my own podcast. I don't know how I would live without it. I mean, right now, I'm not even at home. I'm in a hotel room, and I'm able to carry on doing what I want to do. And it's just, it's a miracle. I don't have to do it any particular time of day. I can't say enough about how it's changed my life. So thank you for your role in this.
Well, I appreciate that. I remarked the other day that how crazy is it that I'm doing a podcast where I'm playing a part of a podcast that has presidential nominees on it. You know, it's like, wow, I didn't really expect this would happen like this. And it's my belief that the political elite of the entire world still think that they can set agendas and mindsets by doing an interview with the New York Times, you know, doing your 60 Minutes interview, and then we're off to the races. It takes care of itself. But now there's so many places people are getting information from that, you know, that I think it was Matt Taibbi who said, you know, the elite messaging system is not functioning anymore, you know? So there's something else that is taking place. And that really makes me incredibly proud to be involved in this, is how we are changing everything in how we share information with each other globally.
Well, I think you're a pioneer in more than just this strictly technological sense. There's also a strategic innovation that I think you've made in terms of how you finance and run the podcast that you do with your co-host, No Agenda, that you've been doing, I guess, for close to 13 years now.
And yeah, over 13, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd like to talk about that. First of all, I want to know about what, I mean, I know because I've listened to your podcast, but first I just want you to explain what kinds of topics are covered, how would you describe the podcast, and then I want to get into the value for value stuff that I find really interesting.
Okay. So John C. Dvorak and I, and he's very famous columnist, he's written in PC Magazine, I mean, every magazine that deals with technology, he's written books, he dates back to the early days of computing, has incredible wealth of knowledge and experience. And I met him when I was in San Francisco, and it was weird because I wouldn't say we're really friends, but we like challenging each other's ideas, and he's a very blunt guy, which I like about him. It takes a while to get used to him, but he'll just say, well, this really sucks and you're no good in this and whatever, and then that'll be it and he'll be done, and he doesn't hang on to anything if you say something back, and it's just, you can start fresh every time. And I was traveling between San Francisco and London, where I lived at the time. And when I was back in London, we'd do Skype calls. And this is 2006, I guess, seven. We'd do a Skype call and I'd read from the Financial Times and we're just chatting about. And then, of course, it was, hey, here's a thought. Why don't we record this and we'll make it a podcast? And we did. And it was us deconstructing media. Since we've both been in, collectively, television, print, news, even some film, but really all of the modern day media, we understand how it works, and we understand how newsrooms and how production is handled, and really all the fakery. I mean, I've been part of nothing but fakery. I've done things that were so fake on television, were intended to fool the audience into believing I was actually interviewing Janet Jackson via satellite. You know, there's you do stuff, and we know how it works. And you know, the reality, as I was seeing reporting in the U.S. that he was telling me about what was happening in London, and vice versa in Europe at the time, is they were just completing the second vote of the Lisbon Treaty to formalize the European Union. You may recall France and the Netherlands said no, and then the European Union went, you voted wrong, time for a do-over. So that was being reported very differently. And so we just kind of started to pull stuff apart, and you see how weak all news is, pretty much all of it. And eventually what that leads you to is you have to start doing some of the work yourself. And you got to go read the legislation. Turns out it's not that hard. It's usually in English. Sometimes you have, you know, legislation that refers to other legislation. It gets pretty tedious. But you learn so much more if you just actually kind of go to the source or talk to someone who knows what they're talking about, if they're an expert on it. You know, like the MH17, you know, the flight that was lost for a year. I mean, CNN didn't get off that topic for an entire year. But there's a lot of people who have a lot of good information. And that's why we turned to our audience and we said, you know, you're not really listeners. We're not interested in that. We're interested in producers. We want everybody to be a producer of this show. So whatever you've got, send it to us. You know, and consider yourself a producer. So don't waste my time. We can only handle so much. It's just the two of us. And that became some real work. And we were doing it once a week on Sunday, which we just chose as kind of a good day to get people, you know, who download this and would start their week off with it. And we said, you know, this is a lot of work. We need to get paid for this. But we're for sure are not interested in advertising for really two reasons. One, we're lazy and we don't want to do meetings with advertisers or ad agencies because that's just horrible. Two, we want to be completely free to say whatever we want. We don't want any, we don't want to have filters, even if it's for a product that is not really that related. I just don't want to have to. If I'm talking about a product, it's because I like it and no other reason. I want everybody to know that. So we said, you have to support us. But we did something different from the typical, you know, hat tip. Also, you know, at the time, blogs were, hey, throw something in my tip jar. And we said, we don't work for tips. You know, this is real. This is real work. So what is this show worth to you? What value do you get out of it? And we started with a very simple example. If we just did 2 hours of this show for you and you listened and you enjoyed it, if you went to the movies and you took someone and you say you date and there's two tickets and two drinks and some popcorn, you're $40-$50 in, did you get the same amount of value out of the movie and what you paid for it as you did out of this show? And if so, put that into a PayPal and send it to us. And what we discovered is that value is extremely different from one person to the next. Whereas a lot of people, if you say, oh, you know, subscribe, send me $5 a week, a month, or whatever it is, get people to do that. But if you say, what is it really worth to you? Some people, $5. Most people, nothing. Some people, 50. Some people, 500. Some people, 5,000. And that's just the value they attach to it. And pretty soon after that, people started to attach meaning to the actual numbers, numerology. So they'd be sending in, this is $42 because that's the most important number. It's the answer to all things in the universe, according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right.
Yeah. Or 33 is the magic number. Here's $33. I mean, and it just went from that to a whole portion of the show, which we call where we do our credits, where we have our executive producers who finance that episode, or our associate executive producers who also co-finance the episode. And we will read out their note, which is typically related to a topic on the show that they have information about, or maybe just, hey, I'm saying hi to my dad, whatever. It's usually pretty short. And then they get the real title. And it's a fantastic feedback loop. And then we continue on with the show. It's become this model called the value for value model, where you can provide value to the show by finding clips, giving us information, sorting through documents, highlighting things, promoting the show. And a number of people really like to provide value by sending money. And for now, for 13 years, we've been doing okay. I mean, we will never, ever be, you know, Hollywood or New York media rich. It's not, I don't think that's in the cards anymore. But there's this, call it tribal media. And I don't really like the word tribe, but, you know, I don't want to say cult or religion, but it's tribal, where we have in No Agenda, we have a tribe of people, which is quite large, and it overlaps. It overlaps with people who also are part of the Joe Rogan tribe or the Tom Woods tribe. And this is where I think the media landscape is going. We will not have the big superstars that everyone sees and everyone watches, but we have these pockets of anywhere from 10 people to 10 million people. And they're getting information, they're sharing it, people are going across these different tribal lines and joining up and finding out more. And it's a hell of a lot more entertaining.
I love this. Now, I guess I probably do my show more the old-fashioned way, in the sense that, I mean, I love your infrastructure and how you're doing it, but I have a platform. It's not Patreon. I started it before there was a Patreon. I have supportinglisteners.com. That's actually just for me. It sounds like a generic site for any content creator, but it's just for me. And because I've been writing books and creating courses and things for years and years, I have a lot of free bonuses to give away when people lend support. So it's not just a crummy PBS umbrella. Like, they really get some good stuff if they support me. But I really, really like the way you're doing it. And I want to ask, because one of the benefits I give to people who support the show is I have a private Facebook group. And that, for some reason, to everybody, is like the best benefit I have. I'm offering them so many things, but the thing they hone in on is that private group, because we have great discussions and they don't have to worry that people are going to call them names or say they're terrible people. We can just honest and relaxed with each other. But somebody in there, when I told people I was going to be talking to you, said that he was just at one of your meetups and I should ask you about that. I don't know about these meetups.
Okay, so you're actually doing a lot of what we're doing, except we didn't want to rely on any company, any single company for infrastructure. So we literally opened everything up and we said, all right, who has a bandwidth solution? And that's now been going since day one. It's the same guy, Void Zero, Mark, who's up in the northern part of the Netherlands. He's put together some kind of network. There are other producers who have, and I've actually met Mark, but most of them I haven't, who help him with that, who manage that. When Mastodon started to grow, which is this federated kind of social network, I started a Mastodon server and said, all right, everybody, here's where you can come and hang out. And this is our place. And, you know, it's connected to everybody else and there's no charge. Just come on in. That got too big for me to handle. Oop, again, a producer steps in, takes over the entire thing. And so we have search engines. We have art we have new art for every single episode. So everyone pitches in. I mean, the theory kind of is you're never going to get more than 2% of all people who consume the product to support it financially. There's no way. People don't have that kind of discretionary funds, or they may not see the value in it. But providing other types of things has a double effect. It's belonged by the entire group. So everyone has a stake in it and keeping it the way they want it to be. But also it doesn't cost us anything, you know, in addition, and we don't have to put up any gates or any, you know, anything exclusive. It's kind of self-policing in a way. The same with No Agenda meetups. This started when I did a couple of times. I've gone around the country, either an RV at a certain point. I had an Airstream kitted out with the studio and everything. And everywhere I'd stop, we'd have a No Agenda meetup and we'd hang out and we'd talk with people. And people would literally donate to the show on the spot, envelopes, and, you know, and we'd have a good time. It's a very diverse group, as I'm sure your audience is as well. And then one of our producers created noagendameetups.com. So you can organize, and we tried meetups.com, and it just, again, it's not great. It's not what we want. And so we have so many smart people. And his contribution was noagendameetups.com, and people go and meet up across the world. You can see it's almost every single day. Groups vary from 4 people to 40 people, and they just get together and hang out and talk, and they're from different ages, religion, race, but they all have one thing in common. We're going to get together and we're going to be clumsy and we're not going to point fingers at anybody for putting their foot in their mouth. And somehow that works. And they send reports, how many people were there, little audio clips. And it is a part of the entire product, which is now not just a podcast of two guys deconstructing media, but it's an entire group of producers working together to create what we call the best podcast in the universe.
Jeez, you are a good pitch man.
Well, according to the Mueller report, it's in there.
Yeah. So just can I possibly keep you another 5-10 minutes? I never ask this.
Sure, man, as long as you want. No problem.
Because, I mean, come on now. This is ridiculous. I have so many things I want to ask you about. All right, let's say something. I know you've talked about it on your show, and I hate the expression cancel culture. It's just a hideous combination of words. I know you've talked about it, but here's the thing. You were in the music industry for a long time. You interviewed an awful lot of people. And these days, it's like not just musicians, but every celebrity, I already know what their opinions are on everything. It's entirely predictable. I can script everything coming out of their mouths, and I know how they feel about people who are different from them. They hate people who are different from them. Oh, they're tolerant and everything because they like this kind of group and that kind of group. But tolerance is not a test of how well you treat people you already like. It's a test of how are you toward people who are very, very different from you in the way they look at the world, and they don't seem to pass that test very well. So you were deeply in that world. What do you think when you look around and you see Twitter mobs of celebrities or Twitter mobs of ordinary Americans demanding that somebody basically be banished from society because of a tweet 7 years ago?
In the 80s, a Harvard professor wrote a paper called The Industrial Revolution and Its Future. And I read this many, 10 years ago at least. And I was taken aback by how well it detailed the future of the technological society. And in it, it talks very specifically, in the 80s, mind you, early 80s, about politically correct speech, the thing, you know, what we would call today cultural Marxism, but also an entire group who has been raised and educated to a degree where they are actually under-informed and over-socialized. And the over-socialized part, this was written before social networks. The over-socialized part is very interesting, where children are taught there's so many different things you can say or do that will harm someone. And you'll remember, it was maybe only 8 years ago, where bullying was in the news and all of a sudden, I grew up with sticks and stones can break my bones. Words will never hurt me. But no, words then became hurtful, harmful. Words became violence. And this is what happens is your brain can't keep up with what you can or can't say. Word meanings change. Inferences of language change. If you throw that onto the algorithm-driven Pavlovian social networks, that turns it into a hyperdrive that can really drive people insane. And, you know, there's plenty of studies of how likes and followers and all these different responses trigger your brain and give you a high, etc. So this is not something that I did not expect to happen. I'm very pleased at this moment because now you can see it's gotten so bad where we have people who definitely were in the politically correct camp and over-socialized themselves are ejecting. So Barry Weiss is an example. I mean, she's a total social justice warrior, crazy thing she would say in my mind, or at least under-informed and over-socialized. So it's possible that, you know, people may all just kind of give up and say, okay, hold on, we've got to reset here. So again, under-informed, over-socialized. And the best part of my story, Tom, is that manuscript was written by Theodore Kaczynski, better known as the Unabomber.
Oh, gosh.
Man, my shaggy dog of the day.
I did not see that. I can't believe I missed that.
Uh-huh.
All right, I want to take it down to something less serious as we wrap up here. I just want to pick your brain. I'm curious about, as a guy who covered the music industry and you interview a lot of people, you got to be enthusiastic for everybody you're interviewing with, but you probably don't like all the music. I look back on the 80s, and I think we can be proud of the 80s in terms of music. There was a lot of great stuff that came out then. But I want to know in particular if there's genres of music that speak to Adam Curry more than others.
Thank you for asking that. Growing up in the Netherlands had pros and cons. I would say, first of all, my parents, when I was young, they had Jesus Christ Superstar, Jonathan Winters' 100-Year-Old Man comedy album, Stack of 78s, you know, a lot of rock and roll, Bobby Soxers, you know, Little Nash Rambler, Jerry Lee Lewis, just Elvis, of course. My mom was a total Elvis fan. We moved to the Netherlands because of the media landscape. I was introduced to a lot of different music, certainly a lot of classical, which always has the best signal. Not that I listened to a whole bunch of it, but also German schlagers, French chansons, Italian romance songs. So I really got a very broad base. Of course, in the 80s, we got pop, you know, and pop was a part of the technological revolution. You know, once we had the synthesizer, which really started with the Buggles, but also Electric Light Orchestra. Trevor Horn had the Fairlight sampling. Then we got the DX7. Once Michael Jackson got his hands on the DX7, it was all over. Then everyone was like DX7, synthesizers, 808 drum machines. So it made a lot of sense. And the music business always tries to commoditize their product. Disco was a great example. And here it was again. You know, we can fit it in and the top 40 radio fits into that. So the industry is very, very clear what happens. For me, I really, really, really lived in the hits. And I know all the intros and the first two verses of every song, but not after that, because then I was usually busy queuing up the next record and never heard that part of the song. So when I was kind of jumped out, and this is around the time Kurt Cobain killed himself, probably, and I went into internet and I was focusing on different things, I really lost a lot of touch. So I missed a lot of the Seattle grunge, really, that movement. But I started listening to a lot of classical, to a big band. I love drum cadences. And upon moving to Texas, where I've been now for more than 10 years, I definitely got into modern country, which is a lot of the guys I know, all the hair band guys from the 80s, they're all playing in country rock bands now. So, but it's very broad for me. I love everything. I'll listen to anything, no matter what it is. There's hardly anything I don't like.
I have for a long time been a fan of progressive music like, you know, Yes or Jethro Tull. And I think when I was 15, it's probably the only 15-year-old who was really cheering MTV when Ian Anderson was the guest VJ for a day. I couldn't believe I had died and gone to heaven.
Do you remember Surrender, the song Surrender?
Yes.
Oh my God, I love that. That was one of those songs. Like that's the song I'm starting my show off with today. All that stuff. Well, of course, Owner of a Lonely Heart. I mean, these are great songs.
Now, do you hosted for a little while a Headbangers Ball, and it seems like since then it's like, yeah, I mean, obviously there are a number of really, really well-known metal bands that play in, you know, huge stadiums, but in the niche markets of metal, you have smaller acts that play to much smaller audiences that tend to be more extreme, that I'm actually kind of interested in these days, that maybe might have been too extreme for Headbangers Ball. Would you describe yourself as a metal guy, or was that just a job?
Glad you asked that. So Headbangers Ball started, and I believe Kevin Seal was hosting it at the beginning, and it was scripted. It was written by Nancy McDonald and Carol. She's going to hate me. Nancy did the most work with me, and so it was scripted. I didn't know a lot about metal at the time, and I was asked to do it because I had the look, and I said, "Well, hold on a second. Let me throw this leather jacket on. Hey, yeah. What do you think?" Like, yeah, you're perfect. You're the headbanger guy, even though I was really not that well versed. I did grow up with, you know, a large portion of the Dutch audiences liking, you know, Iron Maiden, Metallica, but real, real, real harsh headbanger, almost thrash metal stuff, which I wasn't really all that much into. But as I started to get into hosting the show, I was like, man, these guys are really good musicians. And yes, at the time I was married to a musician, singer. And so she had really given me an education in music theory, and her dad, you know, could write entire, multi-piece orchestrations in his head, you know. So I knew that this is musically acceptable. This is good shit what these guys are doing. This is not just some noise. And so when people came in and I would talk with them and interview them, I had a connection with the artists on a musical level above anything all. And I know they appreciated that. Although I think I was seen as a poser, and I probably was to that degree, but I really liked the music. I would play it. I would go to the shows. I would do the interviews. What was interesting at the time was MTV was so conservative. It took maybe 2 years to get Guns N' Roses played at all.
Wow.
And yeah. And so finally the Live at the Ritz concert was aired on MTV. I think it only aired twice, but it was a problem. There was all kinds of censorship issues that, you know, MTV was so conservative. And they had the worst part, I felt, of Headbangers Ball, because he was like this, oh, here's this 3 hours, Saturday midnight to 3 a.m. It's ours. This is our place. This is our people. I did feel that for sure. But then it would be every other two videos, MTV failed to balance it out because, oh yeah, it's Saturday between midnight and 3. We have to play a Bon Jovi video. And I was like, And I was like, why? Well, it's to even it out. And, you know, because they were kind of running it like a radio station programming wise, and they thought that was the way to do it. And that always bothered me. But I love the show. I love the artists. I still am in touch with many of them. As I said, you know, some of them, I mean, I went on tour with Def Leppard, you know, who was kind of in the middle there. They weren't as bad as Bon Jovi. And they still had some crazy good stuff at the time. But also, I did a show with Metallica at the North Pole with, who else was there? Courtney Love. You know, and I really enjoyed it. And then some point, and this is typical for the entertainment business, Ricky Rackman, this bar owner in LA who was buddies with Axl Rose, the irony of it, came in and said, hey, I want to audition for Headbangers Ball. And I brought my buddy Axl with me. So of course, Axl Rose at that point was, you know, you couldn't be any bigger star. And then right away, I was fired and Ricky Rackman got the job. Like, okay, well, that's show business.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering how that came about.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Well, just as we're parting, I'm glad you said the thing about musicianship, because when I was younger and, you know, close-minded, judgmental jerk, I used to listen to, I would hear bits and pieces of music like that and just think it was just a bunch of noise and I didn't need to investigate any further. But then when I started getting into it, it still seemed, you know, a lot of metal seemed kind of harsh to me. I did appreciate, well, I realized that what they're doing, especially the best of them, is really technically very challenging. I mean, what they're doing, yes, is very hard. And especially, like, if you're listening to a really experienced death metal drummer with a double bass, I don't think musically I've ever heard anything that's more impressive than that.
Yeah, people really underestimate how hard that is. And it's interesting because there is the difference between, and even though I like Eddie and Alex and Van Halen and, you know, whether it's David Lee Roth or Sammy Hagar, I love those guys to death. But David Lee will be the first to say that at a certain point, they were Eddie was doing so much in the studio by playing in little licks and stuff that when it came time to play some of his solos live, it was really challenging because he had to kind of learn stuff that he hadn't done all in one sequence in the first time.
Oh, right.
But the metal guys, no, they played that. They played that.
Yeah.
And that was just amazing.
Listen, we could go on forever, but what's the website for your podcast?
Well, noagendashow.com is the website, and it should be available on pretty much every podcast app. And I'm curry.com is where you can find out more about me. But noagendashow.com is where you can find out all the info, subscribe, etc.
All right. Well, I'm going to link to both of those things on our show notes page for today. Now, this is, I don't do shows as long as yours, and I also do mine more frequently. So I think we have the same, almost same amount of content. I just spread mine out more. So somehow sure. I have more episodes than the godfather of podcasting. This is episode 1693, man. So the show notes page.
Nice.
Yeah, yes. How about that? So show notes page, tomwoods.com/1693 is where we'll have those links. Well, Adam, I really, really appreciate your time. I knew this would be great, and continued good luck to you.
Thank you, Tom. And when you have the time one of these days, I have a separate kind of little podcast I've been doing, and I'd love to have a longer chat with you, maybe about some political stuff, because I'd love to pick your brain.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Thanks a lot.
Excellent, man. Take care. Thank you again.
All right, everybody. Remember, they are trying to lock us back up again. So I remind you that the old man here has an ebook on that subject. Your Facebook friends are wrong about the lockdown. You can go get your free copy of that over at wrongaboutlockdown.com. And in the United States, you can text the word lockdown to the number 33444. Get that thing delivered to you automatically. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.